This is the podcast, Surgery IC Rounds. My name's Jeff Guy. Hello, this is July 4th, Independence Day here in the United States. And the first week of July typically is the week in which we introduce new residents or interns into clinical care. And it was really my hope to spend this first week of July talking about things that are really elementary to intensive care medicine, things such as IV fluids or management strategies of sepsis, things that are really considered bread and butter ICU. However, given the events that have transpired in the news, typically in both Scotland and the United Kingdom, I feel compelled to talk about a topic of bomb and blast injuries. This is a topic that many people in public health are quite frankly concerned that the average clinician has little to no understanding and certainly very rare exposure to. Typically often confined to areas such as the battlefield or a rare industrial explosion. The idea of treating bomb and blast explosions are becoming more commonplace, particularly with advent of terrorist attacks on civilian centers of population. The Center for Disease Control here in the United States is actually concerned that an average provider does not have the fundamental understanding of this process and has developed quick sheets which can be faxed to emergency departments at a time of crisis to provide a basic understanding of some of the basic concepts of the pathology involved with bomb and blast injuries, as well as some of the basic tenets in providing the care. It is the objective of this podcast to provide some of that information to the provider. Keep in mind, in the event of a mass casualty, many of us will have to practice outside of our scope of practice. If you are a paramedic, a nurse, or a junior resident, you might very likely be field promoted to take care of patients who are typically outside of your scope due to the massive numbers of patients that are injured and the few numbers of providers. Bombing injuries are not as rare as we'd like to think. If we look historically back to July 7th of 2005, the London Transit bombing, 56 people were killed and 700 people were injured. The bombings of Madrid, Spain back in March 11th of 2004, 191 people were killed, 1,900 people injured. Now clearly a lot of the injured patients weren't patients with Apache scores of 45, but they were certainly patients who required care and attention. The Bali bombings back in 2002, October of 2002, 202 people were killed, 209 people were injured. The U.S. Embassy car bombings in 1998 in various areas around the world, in Tanzania, Nairobi, Kenya, hundreds of deaths, thousands of injuries. If you look in just a small period of time in Israel, from basically September of 2002 to December of 2003, there were roughly some 19,900 terrorist-related incidents. Certainly we know that bombing of types events and blast injuries are not unique to areas outside of the United States. World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the first attack on the World Trade Center, killed 6 and injured 1,000. That terrorist attack was actually designed to be something much more hideous. It is my understanding that there was actually a chemical element of this as well, and when the bomb actually went off, it actually destroyed the chemical agent to create a cyanide bombing. Oklahoma City, the bombing of the Murray Federal Building, there were 168 people that died, about 8,000 people were injured. And then, of course, there's the Atlantic Olympic Park bombing in July of 1996. One woman died, and more than 100 patients were injured. Keep in mind that we're looking at the numbers of injuries. We're really talking, in some cases, between hundreds to thousands of injuries. And as terrorists become more sophisticated and perhaps even more evil, their plots become more sinister and more lethal. Bombings are the most common cause of casualties in terrorist incidents. In 93, a terrorist attack reported between 1991 and the year 2000. This is really prior to World Trade Center attack in 2001. In that period of time, those types of incidents involved more than 30 casualties. 88% of the events involved bombings. Sudden mass casualty situations such as these impose massive burdens on emergency systems as well as trauma systems. We've seen that in the Murray Federal Building in Oklahoma City, the bombing there using a panel truck, as well as what happened recently in the United Kingdom and Scotland using the sedans, that a automobile is an attractive way to conceal and mobilize large amounts of munitions. Suicide bombers also may wear a belt or a vest that they may trigger themselves. We've recently seen in the news, as of just 2 weeks ago, a journalist from the United States was put on television. And he was wearing a vest which was laden with explosives. As I've said, trucks and car bombs carry large amounts, which out attracting much in the way of suspicion. The United States Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau has a graph that is reproduced in many places. It's certainly available on the internet, but what it does is it gives in one column various configurations of automobiles, a compact sedan, a full-size sedan, a passenger van, a small panel van, and all the way up to something like a large semi-truck trailer. And a compact sedan, now this is what's smaller than what was used in London this past week, can carry roughly 500 pounds of explosives. The lethal blast range is roughly 100 feet. The minimum evacuation distance is 1,500 feet, about 2/10 of a mile. Falling glass hazard from the debris, about 1,250 feet. Now, if we remember what was used that was a bomb, the two car bombs that were set to go off in downtown London. Those were full-size sedans. Those were actually Mercedes. They're actually pretty nice automobiles. And if you remember, the descriptors that we're getting on the news was that they were carried fuel, propane, as well as nails, and the nails act as a projectile. They can carry roughly 1,000 pounds of explosives in the trunk. Now, the lethal blast range is roughly 125 feet. So if you're within 125 feet of that automobile when it goes off, and it was in a very crowded area, much like Times Square is in the United States, 125 feet can certainly have several hundred, if not 1,000 people there, and those people are destined to die. They're not going to be able to survive that initial blast. The minimum safe evacuation distance, the distance that you need to be in order not to sustain injuries, is roughly 1,750 feet. Now keep in mind that there are roughly 5,280-some-odd feet in a mile. It's 1,700 feet you have to be in to avoid any fallen debris. Passenger vans, cargo vans can hold 4,000 pounds. Lethal blast range, 200 feet. Minimum evacuation is 2,700 feet. A small box van can hold up to 10,000 pounds of explosives, and the lethal blast range there is 300 feet with a minimum evacuation and falling hazard debris for 3,700 feet. This is why you see all the changes to things such as parking around major airports. We need to provide some definitions, typically here, what are explosives. And an explosive is a chemical or compound or mixture that, when subjected to heat, shock, friction, or another impulse, leads to a rapid chemical reaction or combustion and an equally rapid generation of heat and gases. That's a consequent combined volume is much larger than the original substance. So what is that kind of geek explanation? Well, you basically have a trigger. The explosive changes its form, liberating heat, rapidly increasing its volume, and that results in basically rupturing its container, often accompanied by high temperatures, extreme shock, and a loud noise. Really, an explosion is the process of a substance transforming into a gaseous state. And when it does that, it does it quickly and it takes up more volume. Now, there are really three. Now, When you think of rupturing its container, the most common type of explosion is really when you blow up a balloon and it ruptures. So let's talk about three different types of explosions. There's an atomic explosion, which I think most people are pretty have a mental image of what an atomic explosion actually is. We're not going to go much into radiation exposure. Perhaps we should. Perhaps we should just dedicate an entire podcast to that. There's the mechanical explosion, and that's characterized by a gradual buildup of pressure in a container until it overcomes the structural resistance of the container, and an explosion occurs. Now, the example that's most commonly given is a pipe bomb. But let's imagine, again, you're blowing up a kid's balloon, and you keep blowing it up and blowing it up, and eventually the balloon pops. Okay, if you have that image, now let's read this definition again of what a mechanical explosion is. Gradual buildup of pressure in a container, i.e. a balloon, until it overcomes the structural resistance of the container, the balloon pops. And an explosion occurs, liberating typically a loud noise. That's your balloon popping. Now, a chemical explosion is a similar type of thing. You have a conversion of a solid or a liquid, and that explosive compound turns into a gas, and that gas generates a greater volume than the substance which initially generated it. So it rapidly fills up the balloon, and it ruptures the container, and frequently associated with heat. And that's what you see typically with a lot of these chemical explosives. Simplified, but I hope makes the point. Now, we know when we're talking about gunshot wounds, we have high-velocity and low-velocity weapons. We also have what's called high-order and low-order explosives. This is really depending on the rate at which this chemical reaction takes place, so the rate at which the chemical substance changes its form and rapidly fills a space. Gunpowder is the first explosive used really as a military ordnance. This is a low order explosive. Low order explosives change relatively slow from a solid to a gas state and generally less than 2,000 meters per second. Now, let's talk about high explosives. They react almost instantaneously and they cause a sudden increase in pressure and a detonation wave that moves at supersonic speeds. We're talking here about speeds in excess of 1,400 to 9,000 meters per second. Common examples of this are TNT, which is, some of the more recent polymer-bound explosives, such as Semtex, which are about 1.5 times the power of TNT. High explosives are commonly used in military ordnance, as well as some of these perhaps terrorist attacks. Now, a detonator, you may hear what that is, is a type of explosive that reacts rapidly and is used to set off the more inert explosives. Fulminate of mercury mixed with potassium chloride is the most commonly used detonator. Detonators can also be equipped which by flame, spark, percussion, friction, or pressure are used to set off a chemical detonator. So if you imagine a domino falling, and as it falls into 15 other dominoes and creates this series of reactions. That first fall of the domino could potentially be used to describe what a detonator is. It's the first small explosive that sets off a much more larger explosive of a substance that's typically more inert, and that's your high explosives. The rapid release of enormous amounts of energy in high explosives results in that primary blast wave. Okay, now this primary blast wave, we're going to talk a lot because it really results in a significant amount of injury. And this primary blast wave basically will take fragments and environmental material and debris and generates intense thermal radiation, i.e. heat, and this creates the instantaneous rise in pressure, resulting in a shock wave that travels outward at supersonic speed. It's that wave or leading front, which is really a significant part of that blast wave. Now, we have to spend some time talking about what a blast wave is. If you were to take a rock and throw it into a puddle, you will get an initial wave that spreads out. If you set off an explosion, you're going to get an invisible but the same type of pressure wave that's going to move outward in all directions. And that's going to create a pressure wave. It's going to rupture the container which it's in, and that's going to result in fragmentation, which is going to throw metal, debris, and glass, which will penetrate anybody that's in the vicinity. It'll create a significant blast wind. You will get an incendiary thermal effect or fire, and you could get secondary blast effects as well. We talked a little bit about detonation velocities, and this blast pressure wave is supersonic, and it moves out in all directions, and it uses pressures that really exceed up to 700 tons. Keep in mind, a ton is 2,000 pounds. 700 tons. Imagine being hit in the chest by that. And it's this displaced air compresses, forming a vacuum, returning to the point of detonation. So what happens is you get this massive pressure wave that moves outward. And as it moves out, it creates a vacuum at ground zero, and then you get a pressure wave that comes back. This is typically known as a Friedlander relationship, and if you can find a book or table on ballistics that describes this, it would certainly help make a mental image. This variation in air pressure creates a mass movement of air known as dynamic overpressurization of this blast wave. This creates havoc both on physical structures as well as the environmental structures such as buildings and glass and so forth. Now I want to talk about this primary blast injury. This is the result of the overpressurization, this pressure wave sweeping down and hitting the body. Imagine blunt trauma of a whole different magnitude. If somebody were in an automobile and they were hit a brick wall at 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, you have mental images in your mind as to what patterns of injuries that will cause, fractured ribs perhaps, pulmonary contusions, long bone fractures, what have you. Well, imagine getting hit with an invisible bat at a pressure of 700 tons. The biological effects of the blast wave depend on the peak pressure and the duration of the overpressurization. The effects of secondary, tertiary, and we also cause quaternary mechanisms of injury with these blast waves. Primary blast injury results from the interaction of the blast wave with the body or tissue, producing two types of energy, stress waves and shear waves. Stress waves produced by the interaction of the blast wave and the body's surfaces are supersonic longitudinal pressure waves. Now, injuries typically occur mainly to gas-filled organs, the auditory, the ears, the pulmonary system, the GI system. Blast lung injury is something we're going to spend some time on. Tympanic membrane rupture, you have middle ear injury, abdominal hemorrhage, perforation, and certainly traumatic brain injuries. I'm taking a large number of this material from a talk I've given previously, and I've just recently came across a book last week by Mahoney and colleagues called Ballistic Trauma. It's published by Springer Press, and they have a nice chapter 3 on thermobaric mechanisms of injury. And that's where a lot of some of the stuff I'm coming from now is from. If you look at thoracic injuries, now blasts producing overpressurizations of less than 40 pounds per square inch generally will not cause pulmonary injury, with 40 psi being roughly 20 kilograms of TNT exploding 6 meters away. Approximately 50% of casualties will sustain pulmonary damage when pressure waves exceed 80 pounds per square inch or more. With pressure waves over 200 pounds per square inch, these are considered uniformly fatal. Blast injury to the lung is the cause of the greatest morbidity and mortality from the blast effect alone. Now, the fragmentation effect occurs when the projectiles included in the container. So when the car was designed to explode in London last week and they packed it with nails, the idea was then when the car exploded, the metal and glass that made up the automobile would fragment and be thrown at the air at velocities of 2,700 feet per second, which, keep in mind, is faster than a high-velocity weapon. Something like an AK-47 or M16 have muzzle velocities of roughly 1,500 meters per second. So this is feet per second. So it's perhaps a little bit less or similar, but still very high velocities. So you're getting torn apart by these pieces of metal and glass, much like you're getting shot by a machine gun. And that was the idea behind the nails. The nails create this fragmentation effect, and you get these penetrating ballistic injuries. You can also get ocular penetration in addition to the blunt injuries from the pressure overpressurization waves. Now, focusing on this primary blast lung injury that we see from the thoracic injury, it is the highest morbidity and mortality of primary blast injuries. If you look, let's quote some of the literature here, but from Pizoff, Journalist Chest, 1999, 828 victims of explosions, 17% of the fatalities had blast lung injury as the sole finding. Looking at Pelig, American Journal of Emergency Medicine, 2003, hospitalized terror victims in Israel from September 2000 to December 2001, chest trauma accounted for 31% of the injuries and 9.4% of the deaths. Arnold and colleagues, Annals of Emergency Medicine, 2004, blunt lung injury occurred for 42% of the victims in confined space bombings versus 10% of those involving structural collapse and 7% of open-air bombings. Stein, Surgical Clinics, North America, 1999, 50% of victims will suffer some pulmonary damage with overpressurization waves between 50 and 100 PSIs. Overpressurization waves greater than 200 pounds per square inch are fatal. What can happen is the alveolar septi are disrupted and hemorrhage occurs in three distinct patterns. Pleural and subpleural is one. Multifocal and diffuse parenchymal with alveolar hemorrhage, kind of like a really severe pulmonary contusion. And peribronchial and perivascular hemorrhage. These patterns of injury may range from isolated scattered petechiae to confluent consolidated areas of hemorrhage. Subpleural cysts, laceration of the pleura, may lead to pneumohemothoraxes, pneumomediastinum, or tension pneumothoraces. Lethal primary blast injury potential could present with no outward signs of trauma. In severe blast injury, immediate death may be attributed to a characteristic triad of physiological responses of primary thoracic blast of bradycardia, apnea, and hypotension that is unrelated to hemorrhage. Immediate death also has been attributed to massive air embolism resulting from the disruption of the alveolar wall and adjacent pulmonary capillaries, with air emboli primarily affecting cerebral and coronary vessels. So again, this can lead to, like I said, the perivascular hemorrhages, some of the lung injuries may present it's just a simple pneumothoraces and tension pneumothoraces. I'm reading here from Mahoney's textbook on the ballistic trauma. Multiple animal studies have demonstrated large alveolar venous and bronchovenous fistulas following blast trauma. The Trendelenburg position is not advisable in these patients, as now it has been thought to predispose patients to coronary air embolism. The immediate therapy is supplemental oxygen, with hyperbaric oxygen being definitive treatment of systemic air embolism, although not usually available or clinically practical. Again, look at the numbers of patients that have been treated in these circumstances, and you're not going to be putting these patients in hyperbaric chambers. Alveolar venous fistulas are thought to resolve in 24 hours, but must be considered a continuing risk in casualties that require positive pressure ventilation, especially with application of PEEP. In survivors, clinical manifestations of primary blast injuries may present immediately or be delayed for as long as 24 to 48 hours. Chest x-rays reveal diffuse patchy infiltrates that present a butterfly pattern. These become extensive over the first 48 hours, but are usually nearly resolved in 7 days. Continued progression of the infiltrates after 48 hours should lead one to consider ARDS. So again, hemoptysis and barotrauma are common signs. Rib fractures may not be present. Have a high index of suspicion for the development of a pulmonary contusion. He goes on, prophylactic tube thoracostomy should be considered if casualties must be evacuated by air or when close observation is impractical. Well, when's close observation impractical? Well, if you've got 300 victims. Fluid resuscitation should be managed judiciously. Boy, that's a theme that we see just about everywhere nowadays. Basically, don't flood everybody with fluids. And early monitoring of hemodynamic parameters should be considered. The ideal fluid resuscitation in blast injury is not known. However, preload should be optimized without overloading using crystalloid with or without colloid. In the absence of hemorrhage, many patients with thoracic blast manifest prolonged hypertension for several days with mean arterial pressures ranging between 50 to 60 millimeters of mercury, systolic pressures of 80 to 90, and a diastolic between 40 and 50 millimeters of mercury. The mechanism of this hypotension is not understood. Now I want to talk about injuries to the ear, which may not seem to be a big deal, but I want you to consider some logistics and listen to the types of injuries that you can have. The auditory is air-filled, as we talked about, and it's the air-filled organs that are most susceptible to trauma. It's very susceptible to blast, and the most commonly observed blast injury is to the ear. Hearing loss may resolve in hours or may become permanent in greater than 50% of the patients or has been reported in some series. Although not a priority for treatment, auditory injury should be addressed in 24 hours and auditory canal clean of debris. 50 to 80% of ruptured tympanic membranes will heal spontaneously without further treatment. Well, it's obvious if you're near an explosion, there's a loud bang, there's a pressure wave, you rupture your tympanic membranes, you can't hear. Now, imagine you're trying to organize 400 or 500 people who are coming to your emergency department or your field hospital where you're providing field care, and they can't hear. Well, there was a great photograph years ago. I'm not sure which major newspaper in the United States had it, but there was a ambulance was responding to an attack in the Middle East. It was an Israeli ambulance, and there was a Palestinian that was being escorted out of the ambulance. The ambulance had pulled up. This injured individual ran up to the ambulance, which anybody would do. If you're hurt, you see an ambulance, you go get help. That would seem to make sense. Now imagine you have an area that has, 200 people that are injured. You would not want to roll up your ambulance right up to the scene of the attack. And why is that? Because everybody who could walk will go to where they need can see help, and that would be the ambulances. The rub in it is, if you can walk to an ambulance and you've got 200 victims that are at ground zero of a bombing, they are probably not the ones who need the ambulances. So what you want to do is they typically stage the ambulances at a remote site and bring the most critically injured to those patients to try to protect that asset. The other thing you don't want to do is have somebody sitting at the bullhorn and saying, if you have injuries and can walk, go to your left. Well, if you're trying to get them to your left, that means your ambulances are certainly to the right, because the ambulances are for people who cannot walk, cannot comprehend, cannot understand instructions. If you fulfill those criteria looking at various triage schemes, those are the people who need an ambulance and a mass casualty. If you have somebody sitting at the bullhorn, and as we said, 50 to 80% of these people are going to have no hearing, it's not going to do you any good. So you need to have large signage. And they learn this at places where, particularly in the Middle East, where they have a lot of terrorist attacks, they've learned to develop signs and say, if you need help, go to the left, and hold up a large sign. And same thing with wherever you're doing your triage plan for your disaster planning. Now keep in mind, if people are walking, they're going to go to where it says emergency or help. You don't want those areas being bottlenecks if those are your highest resource areas where you have your trauma teams deployed. Intestinal injuries may be overshadowed by the more immediate life-threatening pulmonary and cardiovascular injuries. Lower GI tract is more often often tends to be filled with air. Ileocecal valve area, or the cecum, is the area most susceptible to primary blast injury, and the small intestine is generally spared. The mechanism of injury, as discussed earlier, varying degrees of rapid compression, decompression, resulting in wall damage, immediate rupture, leading to peritonitis and hemorrhage. Multifocal intramural hematomas begin in submucosa and extending increasing severity to large transmural confluent hematoma and may involve the mesentery and vascular supply. Serosal injury should be considered indicative of a transmural injury. Delayed perforation may be seen in some patients up to 14 days after the injury and can occur and most likely is related to progressive ischemia, necrosis with transmural injury or adjacent mesenteric injury. Seen this, not with a blast injury, but we've seen this frequently in people who have a large mesenteric hematomas. If you have a mesenteric hematoma and it goes almost adjacent to the bowel, as that mesenteric hematoma is somewhat organized, it will actually choke the blood supply going to that segment of bowel, and you can have a delayed perforation. Patients can present with the typical manifestations of an intra-abdominal catastrophe: nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, rectal and testicular pain, tenesmus, rarely hematemesis. Again, think about treating 400 or 500 patients. You may not have the ability to do CAT scans, diagnostic peritoneal lavage, or ultrasound. Certainly ultrasound over DPL may provide you with some assistance. Keep in mind that free air and excessive free fluid, not characteristic of blood when seen on CAT scan, are considered to be indications for laparotomy in blunt trauma patients. However, in primary blast with pulmonary injury, free air and even tension pneumoperitoneum without intestinal injury has been reported and should be kept in mind. Looking at traumatic brain injury, still a major cause of death in bombing, accounting for 71% of early and 52% of the later deaths. The thermal blast injury, these explosions will often produce a fireball, and as temperatures can exceed 3,000 degrees centigrade, there is typically about a third of survivors will have burns and will require burn care for that. Keep in mind the different fragmentation injuries that involve. Keep in mind the idea of flying nails, wood, glass, and so forth. I found this for a talk I was giving on bomb and blast injuries, and these are some of the. This is a report out of people who were cared for at Hiroshima. This is some of the notes. It said the external injuries. This, keep in mind, these are treating victims of the Hiroshima atomic bombing, but the external injuries caused to the human body by the blast wind were all secondary injuries due to flying debris, especially glass splinters, roughly 60% of those treated. Some people suffered hundreds of cuts from small splinters, while others lost the mobility of limbs when larger splinters severed major nerves. In some cases, glass splinters even penetrated the skull and lodged in the brain. The next most frequent external injuries were bruises and contusions. Although fractures were rare, the 2%, some victims suffered paralysis due to spinal injuries. Again, that's looking at the injuries associated with Hiroshima. Environmental debris, such as glass, splinters, soil, and various structural particles, are propelled with similar velocities by the blast wind and may well be the major cause of fragment wounding. With the advent of suicide bombers, this brings in a whole new dimension of the biological weapon of the actual human body. Suicide bomber may be infected with HIV or hepatitis or other types of serious diseases that they've acquired or self-inoculated themselves with, and that creates a rather complex dilemma. If that's the bomber and all of a sudden they've set themselves off and now you're treating injured patients who may be covered with HIV infected blood or something else. Almost all penetrating fragment wounds of the abdomen can be closed primarily, and 85% of penetrating thoracic wounds of the chest, obviously thoracic wounds, can be managed just by a simple chest tube. All war wounds, blast wounds, and so forth, are considered to be contaminated by soil, clothing, and skin. High-velocity missiles have been shown to widely contaminate a wound track. Low-velocity fragmentation wounds are minimally contaminated with debris. Bacterial contamination is ubiquitous in fragmentation wounds with soil, skin organisms, such as Clostridia, Streptococcus, Staphylococcus, Proteus, E. coli, Enterococcus. Although infection is uncommon in small, low-velocity wounds of the extremity. Although, again, we're reading right here out of Mahoney's textbook, he says, although somewhat controversial, some reports in the literature support early antibiotics and non-operative treatment of extremity wounds less than a centimeter in size in patients who show no evidence of neurovascular injury or compartment syndrome and also have a stable fracture pattern. Operative debridement of these numerous wounds can lead to increased morbidity and, in general, is unnecessary. So that is a reasonably brief introduction of some of the types of things you can see with bomb and blast injuries. I hope this was interesting for you, but I hope it was just that interesting and informative. I hope this is information that you never have to put into clinical practice, but like I said, many of the people who are in the know, organizations like the Center for Disease Control in the United States, are trying to disseminate this information. You can obtain more information of this from the CDC's website. I'm going to try to post links to it on my website, which is www.burndoc.com. Hopefully I'll get to that in the next day or two. I hope you had a nice Independence Day. By all means, be safe. We are getting feedback from you, the listener, from all over the world. I really do appreciate that and appreciate your kind comments. We've heard from people from all over the United States, Czechoslovakia, Ethiopia, Italy, all over the world, and I really appreciate the kind comments. My name's Jeff Guy. Have a nice day.